Good morning and welcome to Jonesy, the show that brings you conversations with some of the most interesting people in the world of books, podcasts, radio, theater, music, food, and humor, guaranteed to entertain and enlighten. I'm the host of Jonesy, Ken Jones, no relation by the way. On today's episode, we welcome Daniel A. Olivas, author of the new novel Chicano Frankenstein from Portland's Forest Avenue Press. Daniel's the author of 12 books, including the story collections How to Date a Flying Mexican and the upcoming My Chicano Heart, New and Collected Stories of Love and Other Transgressions. His articles on culture and literature have appeared in the New York Times, Los Angeles Review of Books, Los Angeles Times, Alta Journal, Jewish Journal, Zocalo, and The Guardian. He also writes for La Bloga, an online site dedicated to Latinx literature and the arts. In addition to his work as fiction writer, essayist, poet, playwright, and editor of anthologies, Daniel's a land use and conservation attorney. I should also mention that Daniel and I both graduated Stanford University and worked on the humor magazine there, The Chaparral, which may explain why Chicano Frankenstein is not only a moving and insightful book, but at times a very funny one as well. Please join us for our conversation with Daniel, which is already in progress. Daniel, thanks for joining us in the KBOO studios. We're recording this just before your reading at Powell's Books tonight, which is very exciting.
Thank you, Ken. It's a real honor to be on your show.
You're the first person who've ever said that.
No, that's exciting.
That's exciting for me. Now, in a review of your story collection, How to Date a Flying Mexican, the writer Michael Nava talks about the stories he was told as a young boy by his Mexican grandmother and how they were steeped in the culture of her childhood in Guanajuato. You're the grandson of Mexican immigrants. Were they also storytellers?
Well, I only knew one grandparent, my grandmother, my mom's mom, Isabel. And she was certainly a storyteller. Most of the stories she told fell into one of two camps. One was her life with my late grandfather at the time. I'm named after him.
So that was more autobiographical.
More autobiographical, coming to the United States separately. They had dated in Mexico and then broke up because, well, my grandfather had a bit of a wandering eye and wouldn't settle down. So she left on her own and came to the United States.
Wow, that took a lot of strength and bravery.
Yeah, huh? But they eventually reunited.
The happy ending.
In downtown L.A. at a party on Spring Street in around 1925. And then the other bucket of stories she would tell were, well, supernatural.
And there's an element of that in your fiction too.
Yes. Those kind of stories, kind of seeped into my psyche and, certainly the kind of stories my own parents would like to tell, because that's the same basic Mexican American culture they were coming from, steeped in kind of a magical Catholicism of Mexico.
I know that your dad also, you've mentioned that he wrote stories, and he used an old typewriter, kind of like the kind that Hemingway used.
Yes.
But he was unable to sell them, unfortunately.
Yeah, he owned, and I now own, my father passed a few years ago in 2020, and he owned a quiet deluxe, a royal typewriter that Hemingway used. So.
Oh, actually one used by Hemingway.
So. Well, the model.
The model, okay.
The royal quiet deluxe was the Hemingway's portable typewriter of choice. And so my father used to write fiction and poetry. When he worked in a factory in Watts in Los Angeles, he was a young father at the time. I was an infant. He would write and write and write, hoping to get published. And he never got published, so he burned everything and focused on...
Oh, he burned... Oh, I was going to ask you if you had read any of his work.
Nothing.
That's
he burned everything
tragic.
And focused on being a father. He and my mom eventually got educated. They went to community college, and he became someone who wore a suit to work as opposed to working in a factory. And my mom opened up a preschool through the Head Start system. So when I eventually became a writer, started being published, I was already a practicing attorney. I did not get an MFA. I went to Stanford, majored in English.
And UCLA for law school.
And then UCLA Law School, and where I met my wife. And
we have your wife in the studio with us, Sue.
Yeah,
so Sue, you were at UCLA Law School too.
Yes, I was.
Yes, she was. So we met in 1981. a long time ago. And so we started our lives together, you know, got married.
Had a son who I want to talk about because I learned he's a video game designer. He's in his 30s, I think, and it's a job that also requires a great deal of effective storytelling. So this is a trait that seems to run in your family.
Right. Though it's a different kind of title. I always get this wrong. He's in the video game design industry. He works for a very large company, Epic. And my wife knows the term. What is his title?
He's a creative content implementer.
Yes.
Oh.
Yes.
So he does technical art.
He does technical art, but he's very creative.
And one of those CCIs.
I worked
in high tech for a long time.
Okay.
And I know these kind of lofty job titles.
Okay. All right. Well, but and he works for Epic, and he now lives in San Diego. He's very creative and very thoughtful. He loves, in fact, he's writing a novel too.
So it does run in the family.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Now, in the introduction to your story collection, How to Date a Flying Mexican, you set yourself a task as a writer, and I quote, "I attempt to express the beauty and complexities of my culture rooted in Mexico, the home of my grandparents. Moreover, inaccurate descriptions of my culture are too common, and I believe I have a moral duty to correct those depictions through my own storytelling." What are some of those common inaccurate descriptions, and how do you go about correcting them?
Well, the most common would be the denigration of my people. For example, in high school, I was called a stupid Mexican by a football coach in front of my classmates. He also taught history at the high school.
I shouldn't laugh, but what an awful situation.
Right. And I went to all boys Catholic high school. Mm. So it was not a rough and tumble kind of high school. It was a Jesuit high school. Other terms used to describe my people, you know, stupid Mexican, dirty Mexican. Also the concept that we are somehow invaders. That's one of the things.
Which unfortunately still exists to the day.
It still exists. And a certain ex-president loves to talk about how we are somehow sullying the blood of real America.
And of course, some of that led to the impetus behind the book.
Exactly. So I try to paint the culture as I know it, and it's deep and rich. We have a broad array of people from very good to very bad, just like any group of people. And so that's what I try to do. I try to tell stories that are filled with people who are three-dimensional and who represent the kind of people I grew up with, people who are members of, you know, similar to my family members. And my hope is that, number one, I entertain. And number two, allow people who maybe don't know the culture and the people to get a glimpse that is more accurate and is less, certainly less tied to the kind of stereotypes that are too common in our society.
Yeah, it just reminded me of a line from Jerry Seinfeld, who's Jewish, and you are too,
yes.
Converted. We'll talk a little bit about that. But he mentioned that Jew is a word that can be used both as a description and as a slur. And I think Mexicans the same way. In other words, I'm a Jew. He's a Jew. I'm Mexican. Oh, he's Mexican. Like
right.
That.
Yeah, exactly.
Works both ways.
Exactly. It depends on who is saying it.
Yes, right? And the tone, I guess.
Yes.
So the book itself, which I loved, Chicano Frankenstein, you have an author's note in the back, which was very revealing for me, especially to talk with you and ask some questions. You talk about your lifelong passion for the Frankenstein story after watching the famous 1931 movie with Boris Karloff as the monster. And you were just 5 years old when you watched it. I think I was much later, but I had nightmares. But I think we were both obsessed. Then you read Mary Shelley's book in high school. What do you think about the story, Mary Shelley's story, the movie interpretations that attracted you and captivated your imagination?
Well, first the movie. And I've rewatched the film very recently, particularly when I was starting to write this novel in 2022. There are certain iconic images from that film, which are repeated now, even to this day, in horror films. Probably most famously in the movie Young Frankenstein by Mel Brooks.
I think he used the original laboratory from the 1931 production.
He got the, yes, he was able to use the original set. Mm-hmm. And his movie, in many ways, was a love letter to the original film because there were so many beautiful, remarkable images, including two particular elements. One, the makeup, which was highly unusual and quite frightening, certainly at the time. And when I saw it for the first time, I know I was frightened, but I couldn't stop looking. And the other was Boris Karloff and what he did to bring the creature.
What an incredible acting job under those layers of makeup that took hours and hours to apply every morning. And he still shows some sensitivity there, especially in the scene with the little girl. Spoiler alert, he accidentally kills her and the villagers turn against him. But he didn't mean to.
No, he didn't mean to. And Jack Pierce was the makeup artist. And he had suggested to Pierce that his eyes were too alive. So he suggested that his upper eyelids be compressed somehow with putty to make them look sleepy and droopy, because he's a reanimated person, so he shouldn't be fully vibrant and alive. And so Jack Pierce actually took that advice.
And yet there was a lot emoted through those eyes.
Yes, yes.
I remember it well. I also saw the movie quite a few times.
truly great actors can act through makeup. Lon Chaney Sr. and Lon Chaney Jr. both could, for example, Lon Chaney Sr., who played The Phantom and Phantom of the Opera.
And Lon Chaney Jr., the Wolfman.
And Wolfman, years later, they were able to create characters that could emote through the makeup. Great actors could do that with their eyes and their mouths. And Boris Karloff could do it with just a mere twitch of his face and his mouth to show the kind of pain he was, the inner turmoil that he...
So you got all that as a five-year-old, huh?
You
saw kind of the monstrous aspect, but also that this was a human in there, a very sensitive one.
Right, and in particular, the scene where he is with the child. That scene was probably the most important scene for me as a young child, because, of course, that child is around my age, yet she gets killed. And my parents explained to me that he didn't mean to do it. I do remember that because it is a very frightening scene. But as an adult, as I watched the film growing up and then read the novel itself, as an adult, I began to realize and understand the turmoil, the true turmoil that he was going through, to be rejected by his creator, essentially rejected by his father.
His father.
And what that would do to someone. And in the novel, of course, the creature is quite eloquent, and he gives a couple really very powerful speeches where he's trying to explain the turmoil that he's in. And it was really Mary Shelley's genius that she could come up with a monster that you could also, you know, empathize with and feel sorry for.
Now, you started writing, you mentioned in 2022, so October 2022, and this amazed me, you finished about a month and a half later, I think the end of November. Right. So it came very quickly, and while you were working your day job as an attorney, it's almost like the book was compelling you to write it.
Yes, I was compelled, and I kept track on my iPhone on a calendar, indicating when I would write in the morning, then do my day job, then write in the evening and work on weekends. And then there was a Thanksgiving holiday in there. And the novel, I hate it when people say it, something writes itself. It didn't write itself.
Oh, obviously
you
not.
Know, I spent certainly at least a year thinking about it. And the midterm elections of that year, yet again, the anti-immigrant rhetoric was just in full swing. And
the invasion from the South of rapists and murderers.
Exactly.
And,
and so I felt like I needed to go big. And I went, for a novel. And I wanted to go to the question of, you know, who really is the monster? And the best example of that is is Mary Shelley's Frankenstein. So I used her novel as inspiration to come up with my own story, which is in many ways quite different, yet it does refer to the novel. In fact, within the novel itself, there's explicit discussions about who is the Frankenstein, who is the monster, and reference to a wonderful writer named Eileen Hunt, who's written on Mary Shelley and Frankenstein. So it certainly embraces the novel that Mary Shelley created, but it goes off on its own into a different direction.
And it has other influences too. I thought it was appropriate that just like Frankenstein's monster, the book is stitched together from various parts. First of all, it's a blend of several genres. So there's sci-fi, horror, political satire, even romance between mm-hmm. the man and his girlfriend, Faustina. Mm-hmm. The narrative itself includes bits and pieces like fictitious news articles, transcripts from White House meetings, network news segments. And two of the chapters, as we find out at the end of the book or in notes, are based on previously published pieces. One that goes back as far as 2003. So as a novelist, you're somewhat of a Dr. Frankenstein yourself, taking these different parts and bringing it to life.
Mm-hmm. So, yes, I'm primarily a short story writer, and I use very concise language. The novel itself is only about 48,000 words, so it's a very short novel. And in crafting a short story, I tend to keep things very... Well, there isn't a wasted word. And in crafting this, I had to approach it from a different angle, because writing a short story is very different from writing a novel. And I thought that if I set up two levels of storytelling within the novel, I'd be able to express a few basic messages about humanity. So there is the macro and the micro. So the micro follows an unnamed man who has been reanimated. There are 12 million reanimated people in the United States at this
and
time.
And 100 billion across the world.
100 billion across the world. And essentially, in the reanimation process, reanimated people have their histories wiped. So they're clean slates. They still have their basic skills that they learned in school. And so basically, if they fill out a donor card, they can be part of the reanimation process. But once you're reanimated, your face and your vocal cords and your fingerprints, everything's changed.
So your previous friends and family don't recognize you.
Yes. So essentially you're dead. Your families have mourned you and you're put back into the workforce. And these are people at all different levels. And only people who are relatively healthy already can be part of this. And so I do follow this one unnamed man, and he's in his third year of reanimation. He's a paralegal, and he begins to fall in love. And he's goes on a journey, basically, to discover who he was. The macro level are the chapters that you mentioned that are like transcripts from CNN interviews or MSNBC election night.
Fictitious transcripts, but with real people.
Exactly. Fictitious.
Anderson Cooper.
Cooper, for example, makes an appearance. And that is the macro storyline, which talks about the political element, the political rhetoric that is being developed to use the reanimated population as a political cudgel. And I have a right-wing president named Mary Beth Cadwalader. She's in her second term, and she wants to make certain she can maintain the House and Senate so that her legacy will remain intact, that her judicial appointees can be approved. And so she decides to push a political mantra, make America safe again, or MASA.
MASA, which has other connotations too.
Yes, for those people. Yes, for those people who love Mexican food, they will know what MASA means. And so she plots basically to use the reanimated population as a way to really pump up her numbers in terms of the House and Senate elections.
We mentioned, in fact, I think Daniel, you just mentioned it, that this reanimated man is just called the man throughout the book, though he probably has a name in his daily life that we never really find out about. Occasionally, his girlfriend will call him guapo, meaning handsome.
Yes.
But we don't learn the name. It's also true of the reanimated main character in Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, who's referred to as the monster or the creature. Mm-hmm. A lot of people conflate Dr. Frankenstein with the monster, so that's why we call him Frankenstein now.
Right.
But, of course, that's not in Shelley's novel. You said you were shocked to learn when you first read the book in high school that the creature remains nameless. Why did you do the same thing with the man? It kind of almost makes him an everyman.
Yes, and it also fits, for me at least, with the concept of assimilation. The fact that he's been wiped and then desperately desires a connection to who he was and what his culture was, and having his appetite whetted by the fact that Faustina Godinez has a wonderfully rich family. She has her Mexican mother. She has
Veronica.
Veronica.
And her second husband, Saul.
Saul, who's Jewish.
Jewish.
And her parents met at the cemetery. So there's meet cute kind of situation for them.
There's the romance genre, the Hallmark genre.
Right. So they have a romance. And so the man is exposed to two very rich cultures, you know, the Mexican-American culture and the Jewish culture. And in his belongings, the doctor who reanimated him left a business card. And the business card says in handwriting, when you're ready. And this is one of the things that had prompted the president to outlaw reanimation, violation of the code of ethics, that the reanimation doctors were not supposed to let the reanimated subjects know who they were before. And, you know, the president and her party basically like having cultures wiped. And so the man decides to go on a journey to meet with his Dr. Frankenstein.
And his creator.
His creator, and to find out more about who he was.
Now, the man in the book, some of the reanimated are not, they don't look reanimated. This man, the main character, does, because he's got a mismatched, he's Latino, but he has, I think, a left arm and leg, maybe, that's white, because he died in a car crash and those were damaged, so they replaced the parts. That sets him apart from, you know, people can recognize that, and sometimes he gets some slurs. So that saddens him. He thinks, and I'm quoting from the book, how could anyone be so cruel as to deny him the modest gift to conformity, that inner peace that springs from ordinariness, an opportunity to simply be only himself and not contain many? He didn't seem to belong anywhere. And that's, again, the analogy that's true of a lot of immigrants who come to our country and can't pass as white or don't pass as white.
Right. And for him, having a white arm that is actually much larger than the arm that he was born with makes him almost a freak to people. And children point and notice, and employers notice, but he's skilled, so he has a job, and these people who are reanimated are both disdained but needed. That's the thing.
They're replenishing this aging workforce, and apparently there's some kind of significant decrease in birth rate worldwide,
which is based on what's going on right now. Countries that have an aging workforce, we see it in Europe, we see it here in the United States, need immigrants in order to keep, to replenish the population, to have younger people part of the population. And as we've seen in Europe, as we've seen here, a pushback, a disdain for the immigrants who do come in, who are required. You know, in California, for example, where I'm from, if all undocumented immigrants were removed from the population, four or five industries would collapse, pure and simple. Agricultural, hotel industry, garment factories, on and on and on. And
horse racing.
Horse racing,
<'Cause>,
yes.
Because I remember, well, you're in Pasadena. Right. My dad was a big horse racing fan, so we went to Santa Anita.
Right.
And we also went down to Del Mar, and then there's Hollywood Park, the triumvirate. I remember California wanted to pass a law restricting immigrants from coming into the state and also working. And these big businesses like horse racing, mm-hmm, actually said, no, you can't do that. And it was pulled back.
Right.
Yeah, the law was not passed. It was retracted.
So the man, as he laments in the part you quoted, he simply just wants to be left alone. He just wants to be ordinary, but he can't. He's known to be a stitcher, which is the epithet.
Right, a slur.
A slur.
Now, the lady friend in the book, we mentioned Faustina Godinez, and she's a Chicana lawyer who runs her own firm. We mentioned her mother, Veronica, and her stepfather, Saul, who's Jewish. Mm-hmm. When the man sees them all together, he thinks, again quoting from the book, this is what a family looks and sounds like, histories and stories and jokes and love and laughter. And since he knows nothing about his past, he longs for a history and family of his own. That's a refuge, really, for anyone that's looked mm-hmm. upon as different and mm-hmm. discriminated against.
Mm-hmm. And also think about immigrants who are forced to leave their countries. And sometimes the father will go alone and leave his family behind in order to earn money and then send money back. Or you think about, during Nazi Germany when Jews fled and were
not admitted to the U.S. They were sent back in a lot of cases.
Exactly. And, we're watching a series right now on Netflix. It takes place at the beginning of the World War II. And what people had to do sometimes, bundling their children off to go with others just so they could survive. And people who demonize immigrants don't want to or fail to see the humanity and what would happen if they were under such a threat. It just breaks my heart when I think about how any group of people could be demonized.
You're from a family of immigrants. I am too. We talked about that mm-hmm. earlier before we went on the air. My grandfather came over from Russia, the Tsarist Russia, mm-hmm. and to escape the pogroms.
Right.
I always think people like my grandfather, like your grandparents, that was an incredible trip. Mm. It's not something you would take just for the heck of it.
No.
You really had no other choice.
No. Who wants to leave their home?
Right.
My wife's grandparents, same thing, fleeing Russia and the anti-Semitism there in the early 1900s. And
they're not here just to take our jobs.
Exactly.
Which is kind of the common story.
Exactly. Exactly. And you know what? Who's doing the hiring? I mean, in many ways, I think it was not that difficult to come up with a metaphor of the reanimated to be a symbol for really any group of people that can be marginalized or have been marginalized by our society. Unfortunately, it tends to be those who have the least in our society.
So that wonderful analogy that you make in the book, a lot of it comes from your love of Frankenstein, the movies, and the Mary Shelley's book. But there's also some of the story has its roots in Jewish history, and that's the myth of the Golem. The Golem is kind of a superhero in Jewish legend, mm-hmm. a creature animated from clay to mm-hmm. protect the Jews from their oppressors. I think the most famous one was a rabbi in Prague.
Yes, yes.
To protect the Jews. And sometimes he gets out of hand. And the man in the novel is given a book, a real book, called The Golem Redux, From Prague to Post-Holocaust Fiction. So the Golem story must have also struck a chord with you. I was wondering how you felt the difference between Frankenstein and the Golem, and maybe some of the similarities played into the book, the novel.
Right. So the Golem would be the flip side of the Frankenstein monster, the clay-made superhero to, protect a group of people that is under attack. And the Golem is mentioned by my Dr. Frankenstein, Dr. Marco Prieto, who is eventually encountered by the man in Faustina.
That's the creator. And it's funny because he works for a company called Clerval Industries.
Yes.
And I looked it up. Apparently, Clerval was in Mary Shelley's novel. He was a good friend of Dr. Victor Frankenstein.
Yes.
Doesn't make it to the end of the book.
No, he does not. And yes, I there are a few nods, little Easter eggs in there.
Quite a few. Yeah, it's a lot of fun.
In reference to different things, including the Mary Shelley novel. And so my doctor, Frankenstein, Dr. Prieto, you know, he does not like being called a Dr. Frankenstein. And he says, well, maybe, you know, maybe someone who creates a golem, you know, maybe that's something a little bit more appropriate. And in some ways, I think that my Dr. Frankenstein is, well, he is what the actual Dr. Frankenstein for the novel probably should have been.
A scientist.
Yes.
But one with more empathy, more feelings.
Yes, more feelings.
For his creation.
Exactly, so. Exactly. Because my Dr. Frankenstein does not reject his creation. He says, you know, all life should be celebrated. And it's a very different kind of approach to what he's doing.
Yeah, I love that meeting. It actually reminded me of a familiar theme, especially recently, where the creator meets the creation. I was thinking not just Dr. Frankenstein, but the story of Pinocchio, which you all know, he was created by Geppetto. The recent movie Poor Things, the Emma Stone character created by the mad scientist William Dafoe. And it's again, it's a Frankenstein story. It's creation and creator. And even something as kind of light and simplistic as Barbie.
She is
a doll, and she, towards the end, meets her creator in kind of a fantasy sequence at Mattel headquarters.
Right.
So it seems you were kind of playing on that or tuning into this collective unconscious.
Well, it's funny because my wife and I were talking about this, and you know, I wrote this novel a couple of years ago, and it was just published, but... You know, we have, you know, Lisa Frankenstein, yet another movie. Frankenstein seems to be everywhere. Guillermo del Toro.
I don't think it's ever gone away.
No, it's never gone away.
Oh, is that what his latest movie he's working on?
Yes, yes. He's in Toronto right now working on it.
And his last movie was the animated Pinocchio.
Yes, yes, yes. And so, you know, it's been played upon and used in so many different ways, inspiring everything from movies to graphic novels to comedies and, you know, and whatnot. And so, you know, I'm certainly not one who is doing anything new in that sense. But, you know, as with any inspiration, I'm bringing my own vision, my own history.
I think it's a new take on the Frankenstein story.
So
your novel. So it's kind of using those as roots for the story as elements and then kind of taking off in the direction you want to go.
So and I think in some ways I don't think there is a Frankenstein inspired novel where it's more than one Frankenstein. We have 100 million
here
and there may be some films about robots, I think, that might have that type of scenario. But
yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that because you mentioned in the author notes a book that you read and did some research in, Artificial Life After Frankenstein by an author called Eileen Hunt Bodding. And she goes into the ethical questions in creating life. And we've seen the examples in mythology and fiction, Frankenstein, Prometheus, a number of them. And certainly given advances in artificial intelligence, biotechnology, genetic engineering, it might not be that far away where life can be created. And your book takes on the biggest question of all, certainly in light of these possibilities. What does it truly mean to be human? One of the scientists in the book who does, this is Dr. Prieto, I think. He says, yes, I did create life, but that life was a clean slate wiped of personal memories and experiences. All the things that make us who we are, the things that make us human. So he's creating life, but he's not creating humans unless he gives them back some of that their past.
Right, which becomes his second desire to make amends for the process that automatically wipes someone's history. So that is why he is breaking the protocols or had broken the protocols by leaving messages with the reanimated people as they are put back into society, but only if they are ready. So he acknowledges the free will of the reanimated subjects. They're not
atomic. By leaving it up to him. Yes. Here's my contact information. When you're ready, get in
exactly.
touch.
Exactly. Because there was early on, you know, when they decide to be part of this donor program, basically, you know, there's an acknowledgement that, okay, I'm it's not going to be me anymore. It's going to be, you know, something different, basically. And he wants to respect that. He wants to respect that decision. So that's why he wants to make certain that they have some agency and they can decide whether or not they want to contact him.
And that's part of what makes us human, that
right.
That free will, that ability to decide.
Exactly.
And he also leaves a kind of a touchstone of the person's childhood there, a book that he remembers he was read to as a kid. Well, all these memories are very dim, but they're starting to come back. And there's a name in the book. I shouldn't talk too much about it because I mean, there's a lot that readers can discover on their own. But he left kind of a clue there in addition to his calling card.
I think all of us have a favorite children's book that just connected with us when we were young. And in his belongings, when he crashed, he had some of his belongings from his home, and included a kid's book, and his name is written in the kid's book. And you had mentioned that a couple of the pieces had appeared previously. That children's story, which is actually read in the novel itself, which is a fairy tale, was originally published in. Over 20 years ago in the Los Angeles Times in a section where the Times used to publish children's stories by professional authors.
Oh, I don't even remember that.
And they would serialize the stories over a five-day period. And so this was this story, which is the man's childhood book that he loved, actually had appeared in the LA Times over 5 days. And so I wanted to put that into the novel because I thought it might give a lovely sense of his childhood. And also when I wrote the novel, I was thinking about it from a cinematic viewpoint in terms of how it would play as a film. And so I imagined a scene where he could hear a mother's voice reading this story.
He hears it in his head.
And in fact, in the novel, he hears it in his head because those are some of the sweetest memories that if you have a good childhood,
being
read to by a loving parent.
Now, we've mentioned the book includes a variety of genres. We touched on this a little, but there's the political satire, and that also is good use of your comedic talents back from your Chaparral days. And we mentioned the fictional president of the U.S., a female named President Cadwallader, who's very Trump-like, maybe a little smarter. Than Trump, but just as kind of
ruthless.
Ruthless. I was going to use the word evil, but
yes,
ruthless is probably not as much an indictment. The satire part is very believable and close to what's happening with Republicans, of course. Well, you were writing it during the midterm elections where they were blaming immigrants coming across the border and hoping they'd win the election. That so it's satire, but not very far removed from reality.
Yes, and. You know, it's difficult to do satire when actual when actual politics are as ridiculous as they are. And to have a former president, for example, selling his version of the Bible for $60, it's hard to make that shit up, to be blunt. And I might be bleeped, but I tried. And I've been told, or at least... A couple of people who've read the book have told me that they were laughing out loud during some of those scenes, in particular when the president is with her communications people and she's trying to pump up her numbers and she's trying to figure out, you know, what to do. And she starts talking about the marauding Frankensteins, and she's corrected by one of her comms people. Who says you mean Frankenstein monsters?
Making that distinction.
And he explains, and she says, you know, basically, she said, "What the fuck, you know, we normal people will, you know, consider the monster to be called Frankenstein. And what was your major? And the guy says, English. He says, yeah, look how far that got you.
That's way too true.
And I was an English major, so you know, I can
me
say
me too.
That. Oh, okay.
At the same university.
Yes, exactly.
We learned nothing. Yeah, and it's funny because they're looking for something to hold against the reanimated people. And they're saying, well, what about violence? But they can't find any instance of violence, just an occasional shove now and then when people are kind of harassing them.
Right.
So
right.
They can't really make that much. They also make a major mistake. They forgot to realize that the reanimated vote and 12 million in the U.S. could make a difference.
Yes, the reanimated people can vote.
Though they do have plans to take away the vote, I think.
Yes. A sequel is in the works, so to my novel. So, so the president, you know, she's a little disturbed that the reanimated people have not, like, actually killed someone. She said, you know, oh, that would have been amazing. It would have been great. Her numbers would be through the roof if they could find, such violence. All they can find is, you know, a few shovings, but she said, we can work with that, you know.
Yeah, you hear that now when any immigrant is involved in a killing or something.
Right.
Of course, the truth is that more white people, in fact, more white Republicans do these killings than any other group. So
right, the mass shootings.
They want to kind of sweep that aside, though.
Yes. Yeah. It's. It plays up on how people take that and say, okay, if there's one person who's caused a problem, then the entire group of people are the problem.
Now, the humor in the book, again, it's a very serious subject. But there is a lot of humor in the book, and you even mentioned some friends. You're laughing at, especially the political satire. I know you've said that, Daniel, you use humor. It's not just to entertain, but it's also an easier way to reach people.
Right. I think that, as I said before, number one, I want to entertain. I want to make certain people enjoy whatever I write. But number two, if I can get some messages across in my writing, I think, you know, that's a good thing. And humor can be the easiest way to do that.
Yeah, I know in a previous interview you mentioned the movie Mary Poppins and the song A Spoonful of Sugar.
Right.
Humor is that sugar.
Exactly. It makes a medicine go down. And I've been told that the book certainly will play well in blue states, but maybe reach the hearts of people in red states.
Yeah, I want to get to that. I think you announced recently that a big studio has optioned Chicano Frankenstein. And for potential TV series, not just a two-hour movie. And you said one of the execs there thought it could reach people in both the red and blue states, showing that people who are considered different are just like everybody else, maybe change a few minds here and there.
Yes.
I sure hope he's right.
I hope so, too. Now, we're not. I'm not tweeting about that, but there is a public record out there that indicates that a very large studio optioned the novel. And they optioned it before it was printed, before it was even published.
Oh, I didn't know that, huh?
The way, and I hadn't realized this because I had never had anything optioned before, when a book is announced in like Publishers Marketplace, there was an announcement that Forest Avenue Press had had acquired my novel. That's read by studios and by scouts. And two different queries came my way. One from a independent producer who's done some, and I won't say who he is, but he's done major films and television, and then a scout, a literary scout, and that literary scout eventually got my novel into the hands of an executive.
This TV executive.
A television executive. And we've had a couple very nice development meetings and, you know, hopefully, fingers crossed, but things take a little time. But I appreciated that someone saw that it could change people's minds perhaps, and the only reason that could happen in my mind at least is that I created a main character who was believable, but also someone you would feel bad for. And the reviews I've been getting on
like Goodreads,
those different sites, I keep on reading, and this comes up quite a bit from the readers, how much they liked the man. And how much they felt bad for him.
Oh, yes, he's extremely likable.
Yeah.
And almost puppy dogish.
He's just. Oh, because he's very, very honest.
Very honest, very innocent.
Right.
Isn't that part of being reanimated? You have to be honest, right?
Right. There's a comment.
They don't lie.
Well, there's a comment made in the novel that the reanimated population tend to be very honest. And that's because their history has been wiped.
There's nothing to hide.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. They're it's clean. Gone. They're a clean slate. They're like brand new, and it's almost like a, in some ways a child.
Now you mentioned Forest Avenue Press, who publishes the book, and one of the lights of our Portland literary scene, Oregon literary scene, is Laura Stanfill. Yes. How did she discover the book, and how did connect with you and started working on it together, collaborating?
I had met Laura at an AWP conference in AWP or the Tucson Festival of Books. It may have been Tucson Festival of Books a few years back, I think 2018. And she had talked to a bunch of different writers, and she was aware of my writing and liked my writing, and she talked to me. So I knew that she existed. And then when I had completed the novel, and because I am agentless, because allegedly I'm not very commercial, even though people say I'm a good writer. I was
not only a good writer, Daniel, but quite a track record of published work.
Because I don't like anyone telling me no. When agents tell me you're not very commercial, why don't you do this, why don't you do that, I just move forward and do what I want to do. And there are plenty of wonderful independent presses and university presses.
I think University of Nevada Press has published several of your books.
University of Nevada Press.
And an upcoming story collection,
yes,
too.
Yes, yes. Arizona, University of Arizona Press, Bilingual Press, which is based out of ASU. And so Laura's Press has open submissions every year. And so I decided to submit it through Submittable. And she read it, and then she has... readers go through the top choices that she wants.
All very good writers. I know a few of those readers.
Oh, yeah. Okay, yeah. And they made an offer. And so we talked about it, and we had a Zoom, and I loved her passion. I loved the books that she's published. And I love...
Oh, her taste is just impeccable.
Yeah.
I've loved every Forest Avenue book I've ever read.
And they're all different. They're all so different.
Yes.
And she herself is a wonderful writer. She's a novelist. So I decided, you know what? I think this book will be treated well and with respect. And so I signed the contract. And the book itself, the finished product, is beautiful. Gigi Little is the artist.
I think the best cover artist in the country.
Yes. It's a magnificent cover.
So it's a Chicano Frankenstein. It's like a Day of the Dead, Dios de los Muertos.
Yes. So, she asked for my different ideas. There is a scene that is concerning Dia de los Muertos that takes place and is kind of a perfect symbol in a sense for the novel itself. And so we talked about different ideas. So I gave her, I said, I would love a Day of the Dead imagery, but initially I thought maybe something along the lines of the movie poster for the Hitchcock film Vertigo, where there's a body kind of falling down and the spiral image. Uh-huh. It's a wonderful poster. And so she actually did some version of that.
What's the body? Was it representing the man?
It was a skeleton, yeah. Representing the man, basically, uh-huh. Symbolically. And she did like 10 different versions of the cover. And some of the versions were this cleaner version where it's just a skull as the main
And that kind of stuck out for you, and you like that because that's the final
version. Yes, and that was the final version, and I chose that version. What's fascinating to me is that there's going to be a Spanish language version published by Planeta. Planeta is the largest publisher of Spanish language books.
And that's distributed outside the country too, right? Spanish language countries.
Yes, they have a U.S.-based office, I think, in Miami, but it will be throughout Latin America and Spain and the United States. And they have their own version of the cover, which I've seen, which will come out this summer. And it's very different. It's lovely, but it's very, very different. So
I'm waiting for the Hebrew version.
You know what? From your lips to God's ear.
We'll get that. I want to finish up again with a little question on storytelling. As we mentioned, your day job is an attorney. Mm-hmm. And I think in one of the interviews, I heard you say that your fiction writing has actually helped your legal writing, and you made a connection between the two. Really, it's all storytelling. What are those common elements? I know with fiction, it's a character, setting, plot.
Right. So a talented lawyer knows how to tell a story, but also to explain why the reader should care. And that's done through language. And I think my goal as a writer is to tell stories that make people care about the characters, about what they're going through.
And in the legal writing, these are real people, characters in actual cases.
Exactly. So a judge is a very busy person, and they will have hundreds and hundreds of briefs to read, and bad writing, or writing that's boring, is tedious, even if it checks all the boxes in terms of, you know, case citations and statutory citations.
Boring, yeah.
Yeah, without really having clean, clear language that uses active voice, that doesn't use passive voice all the time. So I feel like the same synapses are used in my brain writing fiction as to writing a legal memorandum. It's not that I'm writing fiction in my legal memorandum. maybe there's a little magical realism in some of the legal issues I'm dealing with, but I think that always remembering that there's a reader. That's the thing. Remember, there's a reader.
It could be me, or it could be the judge.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
Just one last thing. It's kind of funny that the man in the book is a paralegal, and right. He's actually complimented by his boss, who is otherwise not that sympathetic to reanimated people.
Yes.
As a much better writer than a lot of the attorneys in his office.
Right. And the reason why I chose the profession of paralegal is, he's not quite a lawyer. In the same way, he's, for some people, he's considered not quite a person.
So a little lesser.
A little lesser.
Career-wise, and also as a human in the U.S.
Exactly.
Well, Daniel, thanks so much for talking with us today. I want to leave with a few closing words from the author's note in Chicano Frankenstein. Who is the real monster among us? Put another way, what person is truly free from bias? Regrettably, I suspect that the monster may very well be within each of us.
Sadly, that's true.
Well, thank you.
Thank you so much again. It was a real pleasure.
Well, that's all for this episode of Jonesy here on KABU Community Radio. If you missed any part of the show, we'd just like to hear it all again. You can stream this episode and previous episodes online at kboo.fm/program/Jonesy, J-O-N-E-S-Y, or just search for it on the KABU website. Before we head out the door, a big thank you to our guest today, Daniel A. Olivas, author of the new novel Chicano Frankenstein from Portland's Forest Avenue Press. Daniel will be appearing and signing books at the LA Times Festival of Books on April 20th and LitFest Pasadena on May 4th. You can find out more about Daniel, his work, and all his upcoming events online at danielolivas.com. Jonesy, by the way, comes to you every other week on the second and fourth Thursdays of the month, usually from 11 to 11:30 a.m. Tune in for our next show on Thursday, April 25th at 11 a.m. I'm your host, Ken Jones, no relation, saying,
it's moving. It's alive. Oh, it's alive. It's alive. It's alive.